Well, this is my second trip to Boston, and they both happened in 2013. So when I was here in the summer with my family on a road trip, we actually swam in Walden Pond. So if you haven't done that, that's pretty neat. Little quite a bit of history here. Lots of walking involved as well. So that's good public health, isn't it? I like Laura's presentation, and I'm going to scale this down a little bit from kind of a higher level down to the local level. So this title is a little deceiving. In fact, Laura asked, well, what kind of boards are you talking about? Long and short boards. You know, this isn't surfing we're talking about. We're in skateboarding. So this is long boards. As was mentioned in the back, this is a form of transportation. It's a form of recreation. And it's a new method of getting injured at high speeds. So I want to recognize Leslie. Leslie Fabian is a PA with Intermountain Healthcare. And this was kind of her brainchild. Ray Merrill is a renowned cancer epidemiologist, and I kind of take credit for converting him to injury and occupational epidemiology as well. So, but this was a collaborative effort, and if there's one takeaway you can also from this session and this presentation is Leslie's from a local IHC, which is a hospital group. We had Utah County Health Department involved. We had the local board shops involved. And it was all part of a trauma executive team, which not only involved one trauma center, but it involved all the trauma centers in Utah County, which serves about 1 million people, something like that. So Leslie then headed out this little group on looking at boarding injuries, because she is the one who's seen these traumatic brain injuries and these hemorrhages. And along with her other clinicians and colleagues, they were ready to do something about it. I have no relationships to disclose, so let's get right into the background. So you're probably asking, what is longboarding? You saw some photos of the shortboards. And I was a skateboarder. I never got into longboarding, but skateboarding was my big thing, and I recognized that 80s wide skateboard, very short. But longboarding has been around since the 60s. Some people call it urban surfing. And the boards are longer. So the board lengths tend to be 42 to 60 inches on average. You know, that's kind of the multimodal area there. But they can be as long as 100 inches, so very long. Eventually, physics starts kicking in, and you're bowing way too much, and your board is hitting the ground. But that's what we're looking at versus skateboards. You know, the trick skateboards, which are 30 to 36 inches. So what does that allow for? It allows for higher speeds. You're not getting your speed wobbles. You're in a little more control at these higher speeds. So you can do more downhill cruising, better for transportation. And then this new phenomenon called carving, where they can actually add aftermarket wheels and things like that, where they can make some serious turns, very much like snowboarding. And it's a culture. So that's one thing you have to remember about longboarding and skateboarding. They kind of grew out of the surfing culture. So this is a culture and a group of individuals that you have to take that into consideration when you're doing it. Now, the photos I'm showing you is from, we actually, as our trauma executive team, we put together an Instagram competition. And we wanted to see who could come out with the best longboarding photo. But there was one requirement. Well, there were several. But the main one was you had to have a helmet on, and it had to be worn correctly. So these are some of the folks who actually submitted and then attended an awards ceremony, or an awards party is what we called it. We had various vendors and things like that and presented the awards at this party. Here's some other of the entries. The winner is actually the bottom center. That's the one who won he's in the lead during a race. Now, Utah is, and especially Utah County, if you've been there, it's becoming a hotbed for longboarding because there's a lot of hills, and these hills go on for miles. And the longboarders just love them. And you start hearing words like bombing the hill. So that's the main word we heard from these. So these are some of the entries. What do we know about longboard injuries? Well, skateboarding tends to be fairly well documented. And we're learning more about the pediatric side of things. But longboarding, I guess I could submit that this was one of the first studies that looked specifically at longboarding. Being very small is where we started. And so our hypothesis was that given the longboards and the length and the speed involved, longboarding lends to more severe injuries than regular skateboard injuries. Okay. Purpose of our study, though, was to start somewhere. We had to derive baseline data regarding longboarding injuries and compare that to skateboarding injuries. So we had a 6-year retrospective review. One of the hospitals there is the only level 2 trauma center. There are level 3, level 4, level 5 in the county. But this was, and in some cases, those other level trauma centers are sending these longboarders and skateboarders to the level 2 trauma center. And there is an ICD-9 code for fall from skateboard. That was one method we used to extract data. A couple more photos for you as well. We looked at, okay, were they hit by a car that was either just sitting there or that hit them because they're right in the road with them? Was it collision with another skater, or was it an isolated fall or a collision with a stationary object? We were able to look at helmet use, but you'll see some of the data is lacking there, and then patient outcome. And there were several other factors, but these are the ones that I thought were most interesting. So in that 6-year period, 824 were identified as skateboarding injuries that came to that level 2 trauma center. 474 were longboarders. You look at our age, we had a 2-year-old actually come to the trauma center on a longboard, and up to 48 years of age on a longboard. Now remember, there are many others who did not show up to the trauma center, so those are not being counted in this case. Males were predominantly, we know in injury that the issues with males, right? What we do know is 45% of longboarders were not wearing a helmet. This comes out of the narrative. What we do not know is that other, there's about 50% in there that helmet use is unknown. So in terms of tracking data and getting clinicians to make this is will always be a challenge, but we move on. ISS scores were used, and those greater than 15 were all longboarders. Longboarders are more likely to have head fractures, traumatic brain injuries, and intracranial hemorrhaging. They had longer hospital stays, longer ICU stays, and in that 6 years, there were 3 deaths among skateboarders, and these were all longboarders. So, conclusions. Now, this is from Leslie. This is one thing Leslie really wanted to show was we need to be able to identify, when these injuries come in, is it a skateboarder, is it a longboarder, and then inform the clinicians that they need to have a higher index of suspicion, and then when treating longboarders. So we may need to, that would lead to a lower threshold of neuroimaging images and studies. And then from the injury side, we need to promote helmet use. So this helmet use, this was actually what we entitled it. It was called Live Long, because we are promoting longboarding. It's not going away. So a couple of slogans that we have were Live Long, Board with a Helmet, and Longboard for Life. Because there probably will be 70-year-olds longboarding sometime. Just like when you go up on the ski hills in Utah and Colorado and the other places that ski, you'll see, older skiers who are wearing helmets. And we can take a lesson from the skiing industry and the boarding industry, because you go into these areas and a lot of people are wearing helmets. But skateboarders, given that, and longboarders, given that culture, there's that lack of helmet use. So that was one... way we did it. In the intervention, we had about 200 people there. We fed them. We gave away helmets. It was located along one of the most popular trails where the injuries were happening and in the canyon. And it was also located at a long-term health hospital, where long-term care, where they had a booth that said, there are some people who are being treated here who are longboarders. They have, they need the long-term care. So that kind of hit home as well with some of these, the younger longboarders. So that's all I have for you. Thank you.
Forty-five percent,
yeah.
And 50% unknown.
Unknown. There was nothing in the narrative. Yeah, we knew that 5%. Yeah, somewhere in the narrative, there was helmet use noted.
Quick question to connect the lecture of the first and yours begins. Are you doing any research to show the most preventative helmet design?
I am not doing that. It needs to be done because. A lot of these helmets, you saw one gal in here that was wearing a motorcycle helmet, which can lend to, you know, those are heavier. They're not meant for these. So I'm not doing any of that.
Yeah. I'm wondering if you're following up with the people who received the helmets at the event and whether, you know, if they're actually, you know, sort of continuing to wear them.
Yeah, the only person I've followed up with is my son. Who got one. He thinks it's the coolest helmet he's ever had. But we did do a focus group with some of these longboarders, and they said one way to promote helmet use is the helmet needs to be part of their skating history. You know, stickers on it. You know, if they had a scratch, they need to make it part of, you know, like construction workers who like to, you know, I'm not wearing this shiny, brand new helmet. I want the one that shows that I've worked. But yeah, nothing along those other lines.
I missed how you were able to distinguish the regular skateboard from longboard injuries.
This was narrative, so yeah. Leslie went through all 824 of those, and physicians, the clinicians would actually.
So they actually know to ask.
Yeah, they knew.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that yeah. Where we didn't know helmet use.
Yeah.
So yeah, this is. It's. I found it fascinating too. It's just okay. We figured that out.
Yeah. There's a picture up there of, you know, good helmet for the bloody knee.
Yeah.
So could it be the cases where they have these extremity injuries and no one's asking about the helmets in those cases?
Yeah. The helmet probably was taken off. They gave it to their friends and said, "Keep that. It saved my life." But now I got to go to the hospital. But I. Yeah. That was fascinating in the fact. And Leslie, who went through all of this. Could probably answer that a little bit better, exactly how she was able to find all of that out. So.
Wouldn't you think that any doctor, any patient from this sort of activity, whether it's skateboarding or longboarding, the first thing they ask is, were you wearing a helmet? Or they say, obviously you weren't wearing a helmet. Or they would have to know helmet use, now whether or not they wrote it down. But the fact, I mean, Kathleen, I was thinking the same thing. How did they distinguish between longboard and skateboard, or even know there's a difference?
Yeah, Utah, you know if it's a skier or a snowboarder, you know, that's a given. But the longboarding, yeah, it was longboarding.
Yeah,
And one limitation that I could see was it wasn't a skate park, so they may have assumed that it was longboarding. Maybe it was a longboarding activity, which is different from a skateboarding activity, which is tricks and, you know, acid drops and things like that I used to do as a kid that I unbelievable. Go off 10-foot high walls. And what?
Well, what I will do is ask all the panelists to please come on up back here so that we can take the last 10 minutes and do some Q&A with any one of you. So, any questions that are sobering?
Meeting, do you think that there's a public health need to go back and update our
my community in Ohio, it is it's a wheeled the community law is about wheeled you know, could be a scooter, could be a skateboard, could be a bike, could be a whatever, and it encompasses all those. Now, I know in my own community it's not even really enforced because I've seen many, many kids not wearing helmets, but it is inclusive of skateboards. So, but I think we've...
12
in our community it's 16.
It is.
And that's just in my, you know, incorporated community within Columbus, so, yeah.
Yeah, Utah, I don't think has any... There are no, you know, helmet rules for children that, on bicycles or longboarding. Now, there is that one trail. It's controlled by the county, and they actually met in a group. You know, they had a meeting with all the you know, the citizens and everything like that. Said, we are thinking about banning any boarding on this trail because they're getting involved with the riders, with the other bikers and the runners. And then they also said, well, let's ban the use of helmets or not using a helmet. So if you're not using a helmet, you can't board on this, and the enforcement comes into that. But they talked about it, but it never went anywhere.
So I really like the idea of, like, making helmets part of the longboarding culture. I longboarded in college, and I did not use a helmet. I know, I'm a bad person. But, like, it would, I actually think it would be, like, a really great, like, collaboration with the helmet company. Like, if you approach them and talk to them about this idea, could you, like, helmets of the come with markers, do, like, art on the helmet,
yeah,
and, like, customize stickers?
Yeah, at the event, there were boarding companies who provided, you know, they provided helmets. And we actually had a speaker who had suffered a TBI, and he came and, that's what he was about, was you've got to put this on. And he went through his story and everything like that. But the local Milo Sport, some of these local shops were involved. We advertised in those shops. So that's why this collaborative effort was a neat thing to be part of.
Everything is
been
kind of pro-helmet, and we're supposed to be pro-helmet because it's public health. But we know in Australia that their bike share program suffered greatly because they imposed a helmet law, and then far fewer people were willing to bicycle, because to use something similar to the hub way, you got to carry around a helmet with you all the time. Deanna, in your research, did you find how many people were wearing a helmet?
We actually had a similar problem in terms of reporting. We just didn't have enough data to figure out how many. I mean, if you think about most of these narrative reports, right? I mean, you have people who are writing these reports, and they're sort of, you know, they're writing them based on their own experience, based on what they think that they should document. It's not so much that they have specific, you know, like a recipe for what they need to document. So no, it's difficult to do that. One of the points I wanted to make was, you know, and this is completely an end up too, but I've had, so my fiance is an ER doc, and, you know, he may be biased because I do this kind of research, but he's the type of person where, like, because he knows now that, oh, we don't have that type of data, like, he'll sit there and be like, so were there two lanes? Were you on the bike lane, or were you, you know, his reports are like, and people are like, why are you writing so much down about transportation? And he's like, it's really important because they can actually figure out, you know, what might be helpful. And the same conversation I had with a police officer who was like, well, why would you need to write that down? And I'm like, it's super important. So at some point I saw him in the department, and he's like, you know what, I actually wrote down whether it was a taxi or not, you know? And it's that sense of I think oftentimes, and I was a clinician, and I think oftentimes we're sort of looking at the crash occurrence when the injury comes in as like, this is what I'm supposed to be taking care of, and it's an output, right? It's not an input. If you think about public health, right, there's all these industries that come together to be inputs, you know, that have to do with the health outcome. And so I think, you know, sort of working with clinicians to write, you know, to write those things down, I think might be important.
So you really come up with a critical prevention strategy, which is that we need our injury prevention and control researchers to partner, right, have partnerships, relationships, or get married
That's it. That's how we're going to solve all these issues.
Good job to all the panelists. Well done. I'm a colleague of Dr. Ferguson. I'm interested in the escape room culture. I do have a theory on the 94-95 decrease in injuries. I think it was BMX bikes that were popular then. Mm-hmm. Maybe there are more injuries on bikes, but I do see in Utah County an increase in this skateboarding culture. My 10-year-old daughter, all she wanted for Christmas was a skateboard, which was on a shorty, which is so dangerous, so many injuries. But I'm interested in Dr. Thurston's theory on this culture. Utah does have a lot of hills and streets. The demographic age-wise was 19, so they're between college and high school. But what are the theories you have on this lifestyle? Why right now it's just such a hot thing?
You know, social media, YouTube is quite the phenomenon, and seeing the crashes, that can even incentivize them to ride, not necessarily ride safer, but can ride harder to know, wow, I can survive that too. We found that in the focus group. They like the surf culture too. Utah actually has a lot of Californians who have moved in, and so the surf culture comes to the mountains in snowboarding, but it also comes to the hills, and it's that free, you know, hair, wind in the hair, and I think the native Utahns they're liking that too. So, and the kids, it's just a cool thing to do.
Why they, I mean, longboarding was.